What's up? Am I on? I can't hear myself. Can anybody hear me? Hello? Hello, hello, hello. You guys remember on Sunday when Rob was talking about the dermatologist? That happened. So he's not here today. He's good. I mean, he's okay. You don't have to cry for him. But it's just got a couple Band-Aids on, got a slight case of the uglies, so he's not going to be able to make it today. So, of course, you know, they asked the most handsome and the best-looking member of Eastgate to step in.
But I couldn't do it.
Well, you guys know I'm joking. I mean, listen, I'm joking. We don't really have memberships here, so I was kidding. Totally a joke. Totally a joke. But we're going to stay the course, and we're going to jump back in, even in Rob's absence. We're going to jump back into Isaiah, where we've been going through on Wednesday nights. And we're in chapter 12 now. It's like 3 months worth of Isaiah. So hopefully we're getting a handle on it. I'm kind of enjoying the study in Isaiah. I'm not really one to much go through the prophetic books. You know, I'd rather read like the Gospels or maybe some Paul or something, or even Moses. I'll read any of that stuff. I'm not really one. I don't know. I think it's good practice, though. I'm glad we're taking the time, you know, as we've always done, to go book by book, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, and explore these different things. So we're going to keep going in Isaiah tonight. And one thing I do with the youth group, generally anyway, I'd like to do with us today, which is to kind of start us off. I usually, because they, you know, they have a habit of playing on their iPods and not listening. So I like to make sure that they pay attention. And so I'll usually ask them to kind of recap what we've been talking about, whether it's, you know, multi-week study or whether it's just knowing what did we talk about last week. So, you know, do you guys have any ideas? Plus, I just like making people feel uncomfortable. It's my favorite thing in the world. Who doesn't enjoy that? So here you go. You guys can feel uncomfortable collectively. You guys have any thoughts? Like, what has Isaiah been about? What's been the theme? What have we been looking at? You know, as we've been going through it, what is he trying to get across, do we think, to the people of his day and then, you know, to us a little bit later? Any ideas? What's been the topic? Anybody?
Don't do bad stuff.
No, I mean, that's been one of his points for sure. No doubt.
Throughout all of it, even in the, you know, the harsh punishments that may be coming along to them, it almost feels like, you know, you're telling your kid, don't touch the stove, it's hot, man. And you're not doing it because,
right,
you know, you don't want to have fun on the stove.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we've documented, hopefully by now, that these guys have screwed up, right? I mean, that you're totally right. But you also said, and you know, that's what we'll look at tonight, and probably every other time we ever come up here and talk, because it's the central theme of what's happening throughout the entire biblical narrative. But we're going to re-explore, you know, even amidst all of that, there is an immense presence and sense of God's love and grace for us. So that's what we're going to keep in mind as you read this, because that's, you know, when things come up like that over and over, we have to take note of it. And so we'll just keep taking note as it keeps coming up. But so that's awesome. That's true. That's definitely what it's been about. And Isaiah, the title of the book, right? That's what we call this book, is Isaiah. These things don't come with the title generally in the Bible. We usually, you know, scholars have just kind of titled them based on who wrote them for the most part. That's most of the books in the Bible are like that. Certainly the prophetic books are like that. And so that's why it's called Isaiah. But interestingly, I think if we were to title the book, if we were to get a committee together and title this based on its thematic meaning, if we were to look at this entire book, what's it, 66 chapters, if we were to go through, read all of it, and just be like, all right, what do we want to title this based on what it's about? I don't think the name would change, or it certainly wouldn't have to, because the name Isaiah actually means either, depending on who you talk to, Yahweh is salvation, or salvation of the Lord. So, and I think that's actually been maybe at the core of the theme of this whole thing. Yahweh is salvation. Yahweh is who we're looking at. I mean, that's the central character here, and who is he? What is he? He is salvation. And that's what we keep coming back to. And it'll be here in chapter 12 as poignant as has been in any other chapter thus far. So I'm excited about jumping in here. And so this whole book, this idea, this book that's titled Yahweh is Salvation, this book is really about that truth, that Yahweh is salvation. And it's about its impact on the people of the prophet's day, you know, the people during Isaiah's time on earth, who he's speaking this to. It has incredible impacts and implications for them, you know, as the people in that day, but it also has a very similar and even more enlightened, because of what's happened since then, impact on us. And it has certainly we're a big deal in that. So we don't want to lose track of that in the process. And what that means, at least in part, is that amidst all of the rebukes and chastisement and everything else we've been reading about, and like Blake kind of brought up, I mean, there's plenty of that to go around in the first 11 verses, and you know, starting next week, there's going to be a lot more of it. And it's there for a reason. But amidst all of that is an incredible sense of hope and an incredible sense of the grace of God. And we don't want to lose sight of that based on all the negative, you know, bullet points that Isaiah's chaptering for us. And you know, because actually it just serves a purpose to better highlight that. You know, you can't get grace till you fall, really. So Adam and Eve didn't necessarily experience the same kind of grace, I don't know, that we do, and that the people of that day did. So we're gonna look at that. And the people that Isaiah is addressing, you know, this is nearly 3,000 years ago, and at least myopically, if he was addressing those people. I mean, he addresses us, and he addresses the generations before us and after us, and this is not just for them. But from a myopic standpoint, that's who he's addressing this to in that time and day. And hearing these prophecies, you know, these people, if they didn't already know, they're reading this and they're realizing, yeah, we've messed up, right? I mean, big time. These guys have dropped the ball. We've spent some time reading about their decisions, talking about their decisions, and I think they could best be summed up most simply and most aptly by describing their decision-making and their attitudes as anti-God. I mean, if we're really going to boil it down, they have been a people group, you know, these Jewish people, you know, these people that are supposed to be God's people have really acted in a way that is anti-God. And so, you know, these people are in no place whatsoever to deserve anything at all short of ruin, short of obliteration, and really the fullest extent of God's judgment. I mean, that's what they deserve. If we're looking at it and trying to boil it down to the truth of who they are in relation to who a good person or who the right person is supposed to be in the eyes of a sinless God, right? I mean, they don't deserve anything more than that whatsoever. So anything better than that, anything that we would say is better than ruin or obliteration or the fullest extent of God's judgment, we can call grace, right? We can call anything better than that, anything better than they deserve, we can look at as just a great example of God's grace and love for his people, right? So we keep that in mind as we read some of the negative things, that they didn't necessarily get ruined or obliterated or didn't necessarily, you know, experience the fullest extent of God's judgment. And so we're going to keep in mind that beautiful picture of the grace of God for them and for us as we read this. And as a quick aside before we jump into it, I want to let you know that I'm just not going to get much into the eschatology and premillennialism and any of that garbage. And yes, I called it garbage. I'm not going to get into that stuff because, you know, and I debated a little bit. I was maybe going to touch on it some, but A, it just has a tendency to put even curious people to sleep. It's just not interesting. And some of us might be tired anyway. So we're just not going to talk about it. But B, and this is really the bigger point, is, and you can disagree with this, I'm cool with it, but I feel like the specifics of all that stuff just don't matter. You know, Isaiah, Daniel, Revelation, any of these sort of prophetic books, I feel like they can serve a much greater purpose than for us just hanging our arguments on a couple of rather fickle verses about some future time. Those things are there, and it's not that they don't need to be addressed at some level, but oftentimes what they do is they cause potentially damaging disunity amongst God's people. And that's not something I'm interested in. So whatever your opinion on all that is, I'm truly cool with it. no matter what it is, even if it's some twisted, weird thing that I don't agree with at all, because I think we can at least agree on a couple principles here. If you disagree with this, I mean, I guess that's cool too, but we can talk afterwards. But I feel like we can agree that Christ is coming back. Anybody objected to that based on our readings? And we can agree that it's going to be awesome. Are we cool with that? Okay, well, those are the two principles we're going to kind of, you know, lean towards. You know, and everything else, you know, will have a way of figuring itself out. But we will forge together in the unity on those two things, on those two ideas, and leave our opinions on interpretation of that other stuff as just that. You know, our opinion and good fodder for friendly debate, even the formulation of a cool doctrine we'll hold to. You know, I mean, that's fine. I mean, those things are there, and they're good. I'm not saying they're not good. But they're not a make-or-break concept of faith. They're not what's going to do us in. And so we're going to keep that in mind as we read this. But anyway, I just wanted to make that clear. If you ask me why don't you talk about that stuff? Well, that's why, because I don't want to. So then these texts, they can indeed concern us just as they concern those to whom it was more immediately revealed to. We, you know, it was revealed, you know, what, 28? I don't know. Almost 3,000 years ago. I don't know the exact times. Who cares? It was a long time ago. It was more than, you know, 2 millennia ago. So it was meant for them, but it's also meant for us. And we can read into this, I feel like, just as much, and even maybe we'll find out more than they could. Maybe even more than what they got. So, but these people, they deserve the worst, right? We're in agreement. They deserved, again, I mean, all of that crud. I mean, they deserve the worst. But what did they get? They got grace. That's what they got. You know, if you were to boil it down, you could talk about exactly what they got, but it's all just an example of grace. So what about us? Does anybody in here ever feel anti-God? I mean, I don't feel like I'm in the same boat as these guys. I mean, I've messed up to be sure. Like, I mean, I've really screwed my life up in certain areas before, and I'll continue to do it for the rest of my life, because that's who I am. I'm a fallen man. But am I eligible for grace? I mean, do we have to mess up like these guys? Do we have to be anti-God to be eligible for that? And the beginning of Romans 6, it makes it pretty clear how absurd that thinking is. Paul reminds us in chapter 3 also, verse 23, a very famous verse, that all have sinned and all fall short of the glory of God. So we're all in the same boat, and we're all in the same boat that they were in, even though we might think we're a little better. And even if we think we're a little bit worse, maybe we do feel anti-God. Well, there's comfort in that, because we see what happened to them. But even if we think that, you know, because maybe I'm the only one, but I feel like sometimes I haven't fallen far enough. And that's, again, that's not to say anything. I'm not saying that from an aspect of pride. But I think that that's something that we ignore sometimes, and we just pretend like you have to fall. Like you have to be like, you know, spend 37 years in drug rehabilitation to be eligible for grace. That's not the case. I mean, we're all in the same boat on that, because we've all fallen short of the glory of God. So from the vantage point of the sinless, from the sinless Yahweh, from the sinless God and Jesus, you and I, we aren't any better than these people in any way. We're not any worse. We're not any better. We've all sinned. We've all fallen short. We good? So what's that implication then? Does that mean that we deserve ruin, obliteration, and the fullest extent of God's judgment? I mean, I guess it does. Kind of sucks to think about that. Let that sink in for a moment. That's what we deserve, you know? You know, we deserve ruin, obliteration, judgment. But each and every one of us, even though we deserve nothing in the way of goodness, thanks be to God that he loves us so much that he sent his Son, his very being in his flesh, to grace us in a manner which was so powerful and still is so powerful that many then and now just can't get themselves to believe it. You know, I mean, that's a problem even. You know, it's hard to believe in a grace that big. It's hard to believe in something that good when we're in the midst of such a fallen world where there is nothing that good, or where at least we don't sense anything that good. I mean, it's still his creation. It's still his, you know, goings on here. But something has happened, and sometimes it's hard to grasp that. But even though it's beyond fairy tale, and it is, and even though it's better than just a good love story, and it is, it's so much more passionate and intense than anything that we could possibly muster up ourselves or suspend our disbelief for. But we do, don't we? We suspend our disbelief for it. You know, we call it faith. We believe in this. We believe that He has done what is necessary for us, and we believe that he's good enough and big enough for grace, for a grace that we can believe in and really put our faith and our life in. So we've tasted of that love, we've sipped of that elegant grace, and even amidst the trials and stresses of this fallen world, and certainly for all of us here, there have been many and there will be, but we believe and we hope in the eternal goodness of Yahweh and his promises of salvation and grace, yes? Okay, well that's right there why Isaiah is still relevant to us today. That's why it wasn't just written for people 2,800 years ago or whatever. So I don't know about the specifics of timelines associated with that. And again, to be honest, I don't really care. And, you know, I don't mean that to come across as coarse. But the promises from Isaiah hold water to me, not because it fits within my charts or my estimations of how it should go, but because the truth of the title of this book, Yahweh is Salvation, that truth I can hold on to. And that's the title of my chart. If I'm making a chart, that's my title. And I'm writing that in Sharpie. And everything else, I'm bringing a pencil and a whole bunch of erasers for. And it's not that those things aren't important. I'm not trying to degrade, you know, doctrines, and I'm not trying to degrade these things that really are important. We do need to hold on to those things as important, but they're not what shape us. And if we're wrong about those things, it doesn't change the truth that Yahweh is salvation and that Yahweh is grace and that Yahweh will be there for us and he loves us. Whether we're right or wrong on any, you know, prediction or interpretation of prediction of end times or something like that, or present times for that matter, you know, if we're interpreting it to be that, then that's cool. I mean, I think God's cool with us being stupid and misinterpreting things. But, I mean, if you disagree with that, that's cool too, but that's kind of where I'm resting on this. So, okay, we're going to start in chapter 6. Cool? No, I'm kidding. But we are going to start in chapter 6, kind of. Does anybody remember, kind of what's been going on here? Chapter 6 kind of started a new section that we're going to wrap up today in Isaiah. You don't have to flip the chapter. If you hear all the pages, just forget about it. I'll tell you. It's all good. I mean, you can look. I'm not saying you can't, but it's funny. I just heard everybody flip. That wasn't my intention. So we're not going to read through there or anything. So God has been speaking through Isaiah this idea of grace, okay? And he first spoke it to Isaiah himself. That was what chapter 6 was. It was basically God revealing who he was and the grace that he is to Isaiah, the person, Isaiah. And then for the next couple chapters, he shifted his attention to Judah. And then after that, for the last few chapters, he's been talking pretty directly to Israel. And so that wrapped up in chapter 11 last week, and that's where we left off. And today, he's going to wrap up this whole section from 6 through 12 in chapter 12. And, you know, it's only a few verses we're going to look at today, but it is, I mean, I'm telling you, you're going to see if you haven't already read it before, but it is piercing and potent in its message of grace today, what we're going to look at. And, I mean, their beauty, their joy, I mean, it's almost overwhelming. Like, if you take the time to really dive into these six verses that we have on our hands today. I mean, this chapter is really awesome. We're going to love it, and so we're going to start it. Cool? Verse 1. I need Luke, Luke's back there, right? Yeah, verse 1. You will say in that day, I will give thanks to you, O Lord. For though you were angry with me, your anger was turned away, that you might comfort me. Have you guys seen those bumper stickers? I actually meant to bring one up here, but I'm kind of scatterbrained. But have you seen those bumper stickers Janelle talked about on Sunday during announcements that were kind of given out in the welcome packet? You guys know what I'm talking about? What did that say? What do those bumper stickers say? God is not mad at you. Now, if you're like me, I've never really understood why he's not. Honestly, occasionally will bother me that he's not mad at me because he has so many reasons to be mad at me. I've never really understood that. I do so much wrong, and he has every right in the world to be mad at me. Yet we read over and over and over and over and over and over again. I mean, it just keeps coming up that he has turned his anger away from us and he would rather comfort us. Isn't that the truth of the cross? I mean, if we're really going to boil it down, I mean, that's really what the cross is about, is him turning his anger away and comforting us. This truth, this grace, this is who God is. This is, if we want to know who God is, you know, Moses asked that question in Exodus 3, right? I mean, if we want to know who God is, that's who he is. He's a divine being that has every right to be mad at us every right that there is, but instead chooses out of love, because he is the very embodiment and the very essence of love, to instead comfort us. And I mean, listen, and I mean this, like I'm not trying to get on to anybody, but listen, if that doesn't blow your mind, then you're just not in tune with the reality of who you are. I mean, it's just true. And it's maybe for some of you that comes as a shock. Maybe you think you're awesome. But the truth is, you've fallen short of the glory of God. We've already talked about that. I mean, if you've sinned, and I promise you have, whether you remember it or not, you have sinned. And that means you deserve ruin and obliteration and the fullest extent of God's judgment. You deserve death. We all do. But God instead offers salvation. He offers life. For that, we should follow Isaiah's example from verse 1 here, and we should give thanks, right? I mean, if we're going to give thanks for anything in the world, you know, Thanksgiving's right around the corner. What better to be thankful about than the fact that God turned away his anger and has comforted us? I mean, that is the gospel, that is the biblical narrative, all of this in a nutshell right there. And for the immediate hearers of this, if we're going to put ourselves in their shoes, it probably had an even more palpable emotional joy with it. Remember now, the Assyrian forces, they're surrounding these guys, right? And what are they about to bring? They're about to bring ruin and obliteration. And, I mean, if God allows it, then divine judgment through them, right? I mean, they are about to bring the house down, quite literally, if they're allowed, if God finds it within his plans to do that. And I mean, this is an entirely legitimate fear if there ever was one, isn't there? I mean, if you got an army sitting on your front yard, that's, I mean, listen, you can be afraid. Like, I feel like that would be the most legitimate time to be afraid. So this is what's going on. And what is God promising them, though? Preservation, comfort, love. You know, they better be thankful, I feel like, you know? I mean, I don't think this is anything they could be not thankful for, right? I mean, God is saving them. He's offering them something better than what they deserved, which is the worst of the worst. Also, I want to take note in the first part of that verse before jumping on. We noticed that it opens with, "You will say in that day." Clearly, that's in reference to the topics of chapter 11. If you were here last week, I'm not going to rehash what Rob taught, because he taught it, and I feel like he did a better job than I would. So, you know, and I've already admitted that beyond the hope of Christ's return and that I believe it will be awesome, beyond those two things, I'm just not really crazy about discussing some of that stuff. Not because I would speak about it with any degree of certainty, because I promise you I wouldn't, because I don't know. But because I think it would be unfair. It'd be very easy for me to perceive that way, you know, as the way of certainty. And I feel like to guide someone into that sort of thought process isn't my place. So if you're really into that, you can go back, and Rob touched on it some last time, and I'm sure I'll touch on it again, because it's kind of unavoidable in Isaiah and in most of these books. So I'm going to let Rob's word stand as mine. I didn't feel like he said anything wrong. So, I mean, if that's something you're into, you can go check that out, but I'm going to dodge it because I can, because I don't have to do this every week. So I do, however, want to keep in mind, I mean, that is important. We have to connect that thought to what happened in 11. So I want to keep in mind the ideas of chapter 11 as we're connecting this into what we're looking at today. And towards the end of chapter 11, he being Isaiah, and really he being God through Isaiah, I suppose, he was really reaching out to the Gentile nations. And this is probably a radical thing at the time. I mean, it was radical when Jesus was doing it. I mean, he made it pretty clear that he came for everybody, I feel like, you know, looking back in the 2,000 years of time that we've had to look at what Jesus said. I feel like he made it pretty clear that Jesus came not just for the Jews, but for everybody. But even the people in his day apparently didn't get it. Apparently that was hard for even Jesus' followers to handle, and certainly the Gentiles to handle, because Paul had to reiterate it after Jesus so many times. I mean, that was, you know, one of Paul's major things he was writing about was he kept writing to these Gentile nations, and he kept saying, hey, you don't have to do any of those rituals or ceremonies. You know, you don't have to get circumcised. It's all good. You can just accept God's love. You don't have to do anything. So apparently that is a big deal, and we can understand, because is anybody in here Jewish? All right, so it's a big deal to all of us, because that means we're included. I was hoping there was a Jew in here. I just wanted to talk to you. That's all. So none of us, so we would all be considered Gentiles then. And so that's what I, chapter 11 was talking about. That's what Isaiah was trying to get across, is, you know, he came for you too. He came for us. It's not just the people of Israel and Judah that he's talking about, not just the descendants of Abraham, because that's what Paul said, is that we're all descendants of Abraham, and everyone in this room can call themselves a child of God, even though, you know, like we talked about, there's no one here that would follow that line without the help of Jesus and without the revelation of Jesus. So, you know, that's an important thing when Isaiah is talking about spreading the truth of God and his grace to the whole earth. We're going to get a touch of that in a few verses. So we want to realize this is the same train of thought that he's coming at here. So, and moreover, I want to reread the very last verse from chapter 11. Luke, if you want to put that up, it immediately precedes what we just read. And so just to give us an idea of, you know, context here, and there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people. I'm super good at reading. As there was for Israel when they came up from the land of Egypt. Yeah, I'm going to read that again because I can't talk. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people. As there was for Israel when they came up from the land of Egypt. So as God brought his people out of bondage in Egypt, he says that in the day which Isaiah is speaking these prophecies, whatever that day is, so too will they experience a sort of exodus from the threat of Isaiah. That's what these people who are hearing it in this time are. I mean, that's pretty clearly, I think, what's being communicated. So when he opens up this next section about this day, at least in part, that's what he's talking about as well. And we're going to jump back to some of those ideas from Egypt and the Exodus in a minute. But let's move on to verse 2. Yeah. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and will not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is a really beautiful verse, right? I mean, he just keeps rehashing and retelling these grand ideas into these small little verses and with such poetic power. And interesting, though, this isn't the first time that the people have heard this, and this isn't the first time that we've heard this. Almost verbatim, this exact same verse is in Exodus. It's in Exodus, I think I typed it wrong on my notes here. It has Exodus 11, but I'm almost positive it's Exodus chapter 15. So in Exodus 15, in that same stream of consciousness that he, because two verses ago, he's talking about that Exodus. So I think that he's trying to connect the dots here. And Moses in Exodus, yeah, it is Exodus 15. Just got to look later in my notes here. In 15:2, it's almost the exact same thing. And it's in Exodus 14, if we remember, we remember the story of the Exodus. Exodus 14 is kind of detailing how they crossed the Red Sea, and it was really the culmination of the Exodus. Like, at the end of Exodus chapter 14, you know, the Exodus, you know, or the leaving of Egypt has actually happened. They're now gone. They're out of that, and they're on their own. Well, they're not on their own. They're with God, but I mean, they're on their own from a sense of being a single nation out of the hands of Egypt. So that's Exodus 14. Exodus 15 starts, and the second verse is almost this exact same thing, because they break out into this song of long-awaited triumph, and they sing to the Lord, and you know, because he provided that way for them. And Isaiah, I believe, is making a point here, and he'll develop it even further as we read. So we're going to hit pause on that side note, and we'll come back to that tangent a little bit later. But as far as the song that Isaiah is breaking into, you know, this rap, I feel like I want to learn Hebrew because I think he's rapping. I feel like this is really good stuff, but I can't understand it because it doesn't translate right. But you think I'm kidding. I really want to learn Hebrew just so that I can read the songs, because I think they're raps. Now, but as far as that song, this is, I feel like, a summary of the book of Isaiah. The entire song of Isaiah is summed up in this. And really, like I said, the entire summary of the Bible. And really, the entire summary, I mean, if the church, you know, the worldwide church is going to have an anthem, is going to have a song, I mean, this would be a pretty good opening line. Maybe a good finishing line, and in the middle it might be pretty good. You know, I mean, this is good stuff. And, I mean, what else is there? I mean, it says, God is my salvation. I will trust in you, and because I trust in you and in your goodness, I will not be afraid. For you, Lord God, are my strength. You, Lord God, are my song, right? And you, Lord God, have become my salvation. Man, that's awesome stuff. I mean, that is it, right? That's everything. What else is there? why even concern ourselves with anything else? It seems like a waste of time. And that truth, that recognition, is life itself. You know, I don't know if Riley or Matt, you guys want to play this song one day. I think it'd be pretty good. Isaiah 12. You sing Psalm 23, you might as well do Isaiah 12. So, I mean, you're laughing at me. I think you attach a mean guitar riff, maybe a cool little bass line, put Jim on the drums. It's good stuff. Make it happen. Make it happen. I don't know where Riley is, so I'm looking at you. Make it happen. I'm kidding, sort of. But really, Isaiah's got a little more to say, or more accurately, I suppose, sing. But we're going to move on to verse 3. And this is a short little verse, chock full of goodness. I like this one a lot. So we're going to spend some time here. With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. I misprinted it first and it said starvation. Totally different. With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. And now we're going to come back to that tangent. I want to jump back to Exodus 15 for a minute. And immediately after crossing the Red Sea, Moses and Miriam sing these songs of praise, you know, to God and recognizing his power to deliver his promises as well as his willingness to be faithful to those promises. So what was next? Does anybody remember? You can cheat and look in your Bible, but you know what I mean? Does anybody remember offhand? And you know, again, I like making people feel uncomfortable. It's what I do. Does anybody remember what happens right after that in Exodus 15, after they break out into these songs and thank God for what he did? Yeah, they complain. What are they complaining about? The water. They get thirsty, right? 3 days passes, and they find water, but it's bitter, and it's undrinkable. And so they complain. They get thirsty. I mean, when people get thirsty, sometimes they complain. But the thing is, I mean, it was 3 days after this incredible deliverance. I mean, maybe the biggest deal in the entire Old Testament. You could, I mean, you know, who am I to say that? I don't know. But I mean, you could really formulate that and say that, and you wouldn't be wrong necessarily, that this is the biggest deal of the entire thing. I mean, they were slaves and now they're not. I mean, that's a big deal. And 3 days later, they're whining about being thirsty. I don't know. But what happens is, you know, God, of course, after they complain and gripe and grumble and, you know, they question that faithfulness that they once praised just 3 days earlier, God, of course, he then spites them and he lets them all die of thirst in the middle of the desert. You know, we remember that, right? Yeah, it was, actually, no, that's not true. I'm just kidding. Actually, God holds their mouths open and he forces them to drink more water than is contained in the entire Red Sea. And it's rather torturous and they end up drowning in no time. It's pretty brutal. It's kind of violent. And then what God says is, he says, that'll teach him to be thirsty, right? Remember that, EVM? No, that's, the thing is, God turns his anger away from them, right? I mean, he could have been angry. Like, he could have been like, dudes, I just took care of you. I delivered you out of slavery. You think I'm going to give you something to drink? But no, he has every right to be angry, as he always does at us, because we always do dumb things, and we're no different than the people of the day in Exodus, and we're not different than the people in the days of Isaiah. And he's going to turn away his anger and comfort us when we screw up too, and when we're questioning his faithfulness and his love and his grace, he's always going to continue to show it, even though we question it. So that's pretty awesome. But what he does in that story is he makes the bitter water sweet, and then it's drinkable, and they're rather happy, and then he leads them to a place where it says there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. So he took care of them, even though they griped and grumbled. So the thing is, Scripture repeats the same story over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It says God loves us, right? It says that he will love us in ways yet unimaginable. And that right there is rather exciting. It says that his grace will surprise us with its sweet, genuine, and bold flavor. Isaiah is saying in this verse, he's saying yes to God. With joy we will draw water, he says. You are faithful to your people, and you do not love us even in these times of atrocity, or you do love us even in these times of atrocity against your name. He says, with joy we will draw water. You've proven yourself time and time again, he says, and we're going to draw water with him. Aren't we? Are we going to draw water with him? Are we going to be alongside Isaiah drawing that water? I mean, I want to. I'll do it with joy. So I hope that's what we're going to do. But are we going to accept that that what has been freely offered to us, that grace, are we going to accept that? Are we going to say joyfully to God, yes? You know, yes, thank you. When we're down and when we're feeling unworthy, when we know we aren't good enough, when the reality of that becomes tangible and painful, will we look to God instead of ourselves? This is the challenge. Will we say, I'm not good enough. I have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But he has turned his anger away. He instead desires to comfort me. He is my salvation. I will trust and I will not be afraid. Is that what we're going to say? Instead of looking at our faults, will we look at God's perfection? Will we look at God to become our salvation? Will we, with joy, draw water from the wells of salvation? Will we, in those trying moments, choose joy, which can only come from God and his promise of loving salvation? Or will we choose despair, which can only come from the idolatry of looking at ourselves and our inherent lack of worth for salvation? Those are our only two choices. We either look to ourselves or something else that's fallen, or we look to God. The fingerprints of grace are all over this book. Are we willing to accept it? That's the challenge Isaiah's making. Or will we choose the downtrodden, empty lives that result from an unbelief in the willingness of God to fill the void? He wants so badly to become our salvation. He's done everything. From our perspective, you know, we're different than the people he was addressing this to immediately. From our perspective, he literally has done everything. I mean, we remember the words of Christ. It is finished, right? I mean, it's done. So why do we choose anything other than God for that? Why do we choose our own salvation, which is just this false, it's not even temporary, it's just total fake. Why do we ever look to ourselves or to another here, another fallen person, or to, you know, the things and products of this world, or to an intangible that this world might offer? I mean, all of it continually lets us down. Even before we give it a chance, it usually lets us down. But we have this tendency because we're fallen people and we keep looking to that. But we have to be careful and we have to readjust our thinking, you know, constantly, moment to moment. We have to say, I'm going to look to God. I'm not going to do that idolatry of looking to myself for salvation. I'm not going to trust myself. I'm going to trust in him because his water comes from the wells of salvation. I mean, I don't know. I'm not somebody ranting as someone who hasn't been on both sides of this. I mean, I've trusted myself, and I know that there's no salvation in that well. Maybe you've had a different experience, but I doubt it. I mean, when we look to ourselves, we're let down. It's been a dry well for me since birth. But there have also been moments when I've trusted God. And no matter how many times I abandon that well, it's always ready to draw the freshest, cleanest, sweetest water that there is. It's brimming with salvation, and its depths are endless. We all remember that faith-based movie that came out years ago, right? It was called The Water Boy. You guys remember that one, right? Had Adam Sandler in it. He's a Jew, by the way. Side note. But yeah, he is. Don't laugh at me. He is. Well, his character, he had a character named Bobby Boucher. Hopefully we all remember this, because there's not a better faith-based movie in the world. You think I'm kidding? There's a scene where he gets knocked out cold, and he's playing football, and he gets knocked out cold. I mean, he's done for. And somebody rushes out. He's the water boy, and he turns into a football player, whatever. But so he has this thing, like water is just going through the whole thing. But at one point, he gets knocked out cold, and someone brings over some water to him, like this special water, you know, like what was it called?
Glacier water.
That's what it was. We got a water boy fan. I love it. You know you're a fan if you know what the water was called. Glacier water. Good stuff. So they bring over this glacier water, and he takes like a sip of this, and he just jumps up, and he's ready to go, and he's better than he was before, you know? And, there's that line I love. That was some high-quality H2O right there. And that's the water that God has, right? That high-quality H2O. That H2O that can revive a man to be even better than he was before. You know, so
the water was blessed by an Eskimo priest.
Right, see? That's like Isaiah right there. I think that's symbolic of Isaiah. The Eskimo priest is Isaiah in this story, for sure. For sure, no doubt. Yeah, it's a great faith-based movie. You should check it out. It comes on TV all the time. So with joy, we're going to draw that water, yes?
Yes.
Are we going to do that? So it says that the water will come from the wells of salvation. That's what it says. And again, I'm going to keep using this to my advantage because he's pretty awesome, and he said a lot of stuff that's pretty awesome. So we have this guy, Jesus, who came after Isaiah but before us that we can look to help us interpret some of this stuff. And because we've been enlightened by what he says beyond just what Isaiah expresses, we're going to take a look at how Jesus describes himself in John 4, if you'll put that up there, Luke. We're going to be in 4:11, and it says, well, you know what, I'm going to come back to that in a second, but let me give you the setting before we jump into this, in case you don't know the story. Jesus was just abandoned by his disciples. Right before this, they kind of had to go grocery shopping, so he's left. Hello? Was that me? I'll just keep going. Nobody's listening anyway. Who cares? That's what I always tell myself. It's the only comfort I have, other than God, of course. So they go grocery shopping, and while they're gone, Jesus is just chilling out by an old well. And interestingly, it was Jacob's well. We know Jacob from the book of Genesis, and it was his old well that he was just kind of hanging out at, because it was the middle of the day, and you can imagine in that climate, it was probably really hot. I mean, they are in the Middle East. It's not a cool thing in the middle of the day. So he's hot. He's just hanging out by the old well. And while he's there, relaxing there, he has this exchange with the Samaritan woman. And, I mean, the fact that he was speaking with a Samaritan woman already gives us insight into the amazing grace that Jesus lived out. But that's another teaching, and I have a bedtime, and we're not going to go into that. But also remember, and this is another side note, I'm good at that. Remember, the Samaritan people ethnically have some basis from the book of Isaiah, and Rob's talked about that too, how this book and the happenings of, you know, the Assyrian invasion and such, how that changed who the Samaritans were and who was actually located, what people group was located in that area. So that's really interesting to me that's kind of an allusion back to here. I don't think that's intentional. I think I'm reading way too much into that, but it's interesting. But anyway, during this conversation with this lady, he says to the lady that if she knew who he was, she would ask him for a drink, and then she would have been given living water. And with that idea in mind, with that exchange in mind, we're going to pick it up in verse 11 here. The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." Jesus is offering the living water of salvation. He has offered to us the joyous event of extracting living water from the wells of starvation. I did it again. Somebody can't type. Wells of salvation, so that we're never thirsty again, and so that we need nothing else because God loves us, right? I mean, we don't need anything else. And because he will turn his anger that he might comfort us. Now, when faced with this, you know, truth from Jesus, I'm sure she's super confused. Can you imagine just somebody saying this to you? I mean, weird. I find the entire book of John really weird, but in a cool way. But anyway, but when faced with this, I probably would have walked away or ran. But the lady, what she does is she says in verse 15, if you want to flip it, Luke, yeah. No, thank you. She says, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." She said, "Give me some of that." And that's what Isaiah is saying to us. That's what he's saying to Jesus. He hasn't even met Jesus, but he certainly knows about his existence because he talks plenty about him. And, you know, the question then becomes to us. The question is posed to us. Will we join them? And I don't mean salvically. I mean, most of us in here, I think, have kind of made that decision. You know, we're going to try to follow the ways of Jesus. We've given our life to him, that idea. And that's awesome. I'm not by any means diminishing that. I mean, that's as big a deal as there is, you know, in any of our lives. But I don't mean this necessarily just in a future tense of when we dwell in heaven. I mean, will we join Isaiah, who's saying this, and this Samaritan woman, who's saying this? Will we join these people day in, day out, in what is described as this joyful and exuberant acceptance of grace, acceptance of God himself. Will we commit to him in this very moment? That's the question. And then in this moment is the question. And then in this moment is the question. And we just, that's how we spend our lives. I mean, we have to, it takes that rededication all the time. I mean, Paul said every day we have to wake up with the cross, you know? I mean, it's an everyday, really moment-to-moment, you know, thing that's going on in our heads, commitment that we have to make. So over and over again, the question is, will we allow grace to overrun ourselves? Will we allow God and his offer of salvation to impact us in the way which he desires us to be impacted? That's what he wants, but are we going to let him get what he wants? Which is really what we want, we just don't know it, right? Are we going to yield to him and trust in him? I'm going to let you guys wrestle with what Jesus says and with those questions throughout your life. I mean, that's not something we're going to just talk about here and it's done. That's what Jacob did, right? He wrestled with that idea, quite literally. So, interesting that it's his old will. But we're still in verse 3, and we've got a few more verses to wrestle with tonight. So we're going to go back to Isaiah 12, verse 4. And you will say in that day, give thanks to the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the peoples, proclaim that his name is exalted. And so we see that again in that day, whether that's a future event or not, it's a relevant and meaningful thing for us today. Let's give thanks to the Lord and call upon his name. That name, that's the same name that holds living water, right? That's the same name that offers life. That's the same name that offers salvation. You get it. I need to stop rambling. And I think I'm running longer than I wanted anyway. But, you know, even though it doesn't say that we need to let people know, or, I mean, although it does say that we need to let people know, you know, there, make known, what does it say? Make known his deeds among the peoples. Proclaim that his name is exalted. You know, he's saying that, so I guess I shouldn't stop talking, right? I should just keep going. He says, make it known to the peoples. You're my peoples. I'll keep talking. So again now, in chapter 11, he was clear that God was dragging everyone into this grace, right? Not just Jews. This is everybody's in on this. Everybody's allowed this offer. And not just allowed this offer, everybody's encouraged on this offer, right? Jews, Gentiles, aliens, I don't care. Like, everybody's in on this. It's not just, you know, the people of Isaiah's day in Israel, right? It's not just them. Or in Judah and Israel. So, you know, once we fully enter into that grace, I mean, I think this makes sense, doesn't it? If we're really immersed in that grace, it seems only reasonable that we would want to bring that acceptance to others, right? I mean, we shouldn't have to be commanded this, right? I mean, this is something that probably happens organically, pretty naturally. Maybe not with you, but we should definitely be bringing that attention to others. And again, not in a weird way. I hope I don't have to qualify it every time that I say something like that, but don't be weird. But yeah, I mean, this is something that we can make known among the peoples and proclaim that his name is exalted. That's something that I hope we will do. So anyway, he's going to continue this song of praise in the final two verses. If we'll look at 12:5 and then 6. Sing praises to the Lord, for he has done gloriously. Let this be made known in all the earth. Again, that idea. Shout and sing for joy, O inhabitant of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. So verse 5 is another retread from Exodus 15. This time the opening verse from that chapter, it says, he has done gloriously. And, you know, I mean, that's certainly true, isn't it? He's done gloriously. We've already talked about how it's past tense. I mean, it is finished. He's done gloriously. That's not necessarily what he meant here, but, you know, I think we can apply that in that way. And you know, throughout our lives, we have that truth to hold on to. He has done gloriously. So that indicates to us that we should probably, it says, well, it's not up there, but you can look in your Bibles. It says, where is it? That we should sing praises to the Lord. That idea that he's done gloriously should, you know, cause us to do that, to sing praises. So, you know, when we see that idea of wanting the whole earth to be able to enter into the glorious knowledge of his grace and his salvation, I mean, that's beautiful stuff. That's not something that I think that maybe 2,000 years removed from Jesus and even more from this Jewish culture, and as people who aren't really in the Middle East and, you know, living in Israel or something like that, or amongst a people group that's largely Jewish. I think we lose sight of, I mean, that's not really as big a deal to us as I think it should be. The fact that he makes this available to everybody. The fact that he's that open in his offer of salvation and his grace. I don't think we make that enough of a big deal. But he cares about every one of us. I mean, and it's not something that, even though it was revealed, and we see it's in the Old Testament, so that's for sure revealed there and in other places as well. I mean, I don't know if we get it fully, the big deal, because that wasn't something that necessarily was understood the way that it's understood now in that time, and even to this day by Jewish people. So that's something we can certainly be thankful for and shout and sing for joy. So verse 6, that reminds us that we can do that, right? We can shout and sing for joy, right? That's what it says. It's almost like a command. I mean, we can certainly do it. And, you know, this is natural for some of us. You know, some of you, listen, you can shout and sing for joy. That's awesome. You know, be encouraged that you're doing the right thing. But there are some of us, such as myself, who kind of need to be reminded of this and let loose a little bit, right? We'll sometimes show off to people, not with our words necessarily, or with our, you know, lack of words, you know, shouting and singing, not necessarily directly with that, but with our actions during a worship service. You know, we just, you know, opened with that, or with just during life. Sometimes we'll say, look at me, I'm a Christian. You can tell because I'm an emotionless prude. You know, I'm stiffer than my study Bible, and I grimace more than a Clevelander, right? I mean, these are the kind of things we project to people sometimes. And, you know, that's not right. I mean, that's a no. Salvation isn't something we enter into on an emotional whim, and that's not what I'm saying. But once we enter into it, there is certainly emotion. I think we've all felt it. We just don't always necessarily show it. We feel like we have to suppress that. And I don't know why we're ashamed of that, and maybe you're not. And I'm not saying that we should be, you know, Pentecostals. That's not what I'm saying. But at the same time, let's quit, halting the emotional wave that goes with salvation. I mean, there is. I mean, there's emotion involved with it. I don't think it's necessarily right to lead somebody into that, you know, based on emotion. But once we're there and we have that emotion alongside of it, I mean, that's okay. We don't have to be, you know, uptight all the time, Cole. So, instead we're going to embrace that, right? And if we really want to let this be made known in all the earth, like it's talking about here, then we probably need to be more emotionally honest with the earth about it, right? We need to stop having these big emotional shows, but we also have to stop doing this, you know. Right? I am a Christian. You know, come on, let's stop it. Cole, you're not fooling anybody. You're just turning people off. You're saying, I don't want any part of that. So again, if that's, I mean, I'm saying this as myself, but I'm assuming that there's some other Stoics in here, and you know, I'm just kind of encouraging you to shout and sing for joy occasionally. It's all good. We can do that. So, and if anybody in here is from Cleveland, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to diss you there. But I would grimace. I would grimace a lot more too if my sports teams were terrible every year. So here in verse 6, we also find where God is. Can anybody, I mean, somebody just read it to me. Where is he? Where's God?
In the midst.
He's right here in our midst. He's transcendent. We know that. He's God and he's big and he's transcendent. But, you know, he's beyond us, all of that, but he's right here. I don't get it. I don't, you know, he's God. I don't really feel like I have to get it. So he's here. That's enough for me. And, you know, he's been right here, right now, the whole time. And he's just as the Pharisees accused him of, right? Jesus was accused all the time of just being amongst and amidst the sinners. Well, he's here right now. So there's comfort in that the Pharisees were right about something. And, you know, they would rightfully accuse him of that. So he doesn't want to be anywhere else. That's the thing. He doesn't want to be just transcendent. He is transcendent, and that's true. But he doesn't want to just be, you know, in the sky somewhere, just playing a harp on a cloud. He's not interested in that. That's not who he is. He wants to be with us. He wants to be amongst us no matter how messed up we are. He wants the closeness to be able to reveal his grace. You know, I mean, I'm sure he's God, so he could find a way to reveal it from some, you know, other place, but why would he want to do that when he can hang out with us, right? And I mean, I don't get it. I wouldn't want to hang out with me. I don't know why any of you guys hang out with me, but why would he especially want to hang out with me? But he does, and that's awesome, and I'm not going to necessarily close myself off to him. So that's his desire. That's been his mission since Genesis 3. since pretty much the very beginning of the Bible, that's been his mission, is to live amongst us and teach us with his grace. So ever since mankind first turned his back on him, that's been his mission, to restore us by grace. So the question again comes back to us, as it always will. Are we going to accept it? He's right here. He's got his hand out, you know, with an offer we can't refuse. Godfather style. I love the movie quotes. So surely we're not going to pass by him tonight without shaking his hand in acceptance of that glorious offer of joy, right? That glorious offer of salvation, of life, of real life, not just this thing that we do. So that's all. I guess we'll pray and then we'll do Q&As. I think that's the, I never know what to do. Rob does it. I'm going to pray and then we'll do Q&As. God, thank you for that grace and for that revelation of that grace and that comfort that you're there, that you're right here, you're right there always, and that those wells don't dry up, that living water is always going to be there and available to us. You know, we sang just before we started here, if your grace is an ocean, we're all sinking. One of my favorite lines in any song. I mean, that's the truth, God. We don't know how to swim, and we're comfort with that. We're comfortable with that. We want to keep drowning in that grace. We don't want to be anywhere else. So, keep us in mind. I know you will. I know you'll comfort us and turn your anger. And for that, we're forever thankful. Amen. Anything?